Great to have you with us here on WPR News. Larry Mueller here, and it's time to take a look at the wonderful world of Wisconsin wildlife. And who none other than Emeritus UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist Scott Craven back with us. And he is going to talk about protecting our gardens from all kinds of things. Hungry critters, hunting. We'll talk about hunting seasons. We'll take a look at some other wildlife management issues. I'm chuckling because he was desperately trying to find the volume on his headphone set.
I can hear now, Larry, so be careful.
Oh, man, as we talk with Scott, I hope you'll join in. Maybe you've got some outdoor sightings that you want to talk about or a question, maybe an experience to share. Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234. Or send an email to talk@wpr.org. How's your summer going, Scott?
Well, now that I can hear, it's going pretty well. Actually, it's been a wonderful summer. The weather's been pretty good. A few hot spells, but timely rain. Driving around, I don't know that I've ever seen the corn crop look as good as it does.
Yeah.
Garden's been doing well. Lots of bird life around and wildlife activity, but it's so jungle-like with the vegetation, it's hard to see some of these things. But overall, it's been a great summer, and it's winding down quickly.
Yeah, I saw an article from the DNR about the bird migration getting going already.
Yeah, things will be underway. There's the blackbirds will gather up and disappear, and the swallows and a few other insect eaters, and all of a sudden it'll be fall.
Yeah.
Which is okay with me.
This is the time of year, I guess, we start thinking about bears a little bit. And there have been so many stories about bears. There's the bear attack. There's the bear with a head in a jar. There's a bear eating in Stoughton, just outside of Madison, eating bird seed and whatnot.
Well, the bears are active now. They're going to be trying to fatten up, getting ready for fall and whatnot. So they're active. The bear season takes advantage of that. That opens up on September 3rd, which is just a few weeks away. So, yes, there's a lot of activity, and a few things have happened that have caught the public eye. I think the bear attack is
serious.
Well, it's a serious thing, but I'm not sure they're ever going to figure out exactly what precipitated it, but the fact that there was a cub up a tree in the area is pretty suspicious, and they were unable to capture the bear. So I think that story is put to rest unless some new evidence shows up for some reason. The bear with the bottle or jug on its head is an interesting one, but I've seen that happen myself, not with bears, but with other animals that are foraging around where there's trash or debris, and, ooh, there's a little bit of jelly in the bottom of that jar, and I'll stick my head in there and get it. So that was what precipitated my finding a skunk with a jelly jar stuck on its head a few years ago. And so that kind of thing does happen. It's in some ways, that's sort of humorous. The bear's got a jug on its head, but it's a life-threatening situation for the animal. So the take-home message, I think, is pick up your trash and don't leave that kind of thing out on the landscape where it can cause a problem for anything from a small frog or an insect up to something the size of a bear. So,
yeah. And the bear sort of eating away on the bird seed and so forth. That one you just have to kind of pack it away for a little while, I guess.
I guess there the take-home message is that a bear could turn up anywhere in the state, even though the northern third or half of the stronghold for bears, they get around the countryside. And, hey, if you see one, there have been records here in Dane County and Iowa County and so forth, so not out of the question, but just be a little cautious, give them a wide berth, and chances are they're on the move. And refill your feeder.
Yeah, and I saw that applications for bear hunting licenses was a record number of people. It was something like over 32,000 people applied.
A lot of people applied, and
so about one in three or so
actually drew a harvest permit, and my son was one of the lucky ones, but he had 12 preference points, so 12 years worth of points. So depending on the bear harvest unit that you're applying for, he was in B. That has a high application rate. There are other units where you might draw a tag with only one or two or three preference points. So you have to manage your applications a little bit if you want to hunt bears. But I'll be going out with son Jeff on September 3rd, and we've got a friend up in the Rhinelander area who has hounds, and we're looking at, that's what I did 3 years ago when I wanted to experience the whole thing, and it was, well, it was interesting.
Interesting.
And we had a good time, and I'm anxious to go out with Jeff and see what he can do, so we'll see.
And preference points, by the way, somebody's wondering about that already. You apply and you get a point if you're...
You can apply just for the point. For example, if you're looking to hunt in the unit that I was just mentioning, Unit B, it's not worth applying for the harvest permit, so you have the option of just buying the preference point, essentially, and accumulate those over time. And a lot of applications. This is a common thing in the western states. Mm-hmm. So for people who hunt out west or have kids or whatever, I know a lot of people who manage spreadsheets on the different western states for different species and keep track of their points and then get the kids into the mix early so that they can accumulate enough points for whatever it is. If it's a trophy elk unit in Colorado or New Mexico, for example, I've known people who have burned 25 years worth of points to draw a tag that they coveted for a long time. So it really takes some data management and persistence and long-range planning to get involved in some of these hunting opportunities. But that just gives you some idea of what the demand is.
Tom in Madison has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Tom.
Hello, good afternoon. Happy fall is coming to all. I'm wondering, Scott, if this smoke that we're all well aware of that we've been dealing with again this year,
You're breaking up, but I got your point. How do the air alerts affect animals, our wild animals?
Well, it's a good question and an obvious one. I've kind of wondered about it myself. It's bothering some of us, but I suspect that most of these animals that are exposed to everything from car exhaust to fumes from pesticide spray, whatever, have acclimated to that. And I'm guessing it's not a problem. I've not heard anything about any kinds of die-offs or anything like that. So I think it's hopefully it'll go away soon. It's been awfully persistent, and it makes me wonder.
About the wildlife that are in the areas where the fires exist.
Well, and the people and everything else. Yeah. It's been burning for, seems like, 2 months now, so there must be some awfully large fires going on, but we don't hear so much about that because I think it's largely uninhabited area, but... Anyway, I don't think it's a big problem for wildlife, and hopefully as the wind shifts and we have a good day, bad day, good day, bad day, the animals are adapting to it as well.
Esty in Madison, we'll give you a chance. Hi, Esty.
Hi. So I wanted to tell you guys that probably a couple of weeks ago, I was driving home at night when this creature ran right in front of my car. It looked almost like a house cat, except it had much longer legs, very long tail, and upright ears. And it was running away from an area where I know there's chickens and, you know, crossing the street. So when I got home, I was very curious, and I described it to AI, which came back with it would be a servo or a caracal. I looked at photos, and it looked exactly like a servo. So I put that on social media, and that started a big debate with some people convinced that it's a bobcat, even though of course it had a very long tail. And
Well, I think I'm pretty sure you did not see a serval.
No, neither of the animals said, I'm not as smart as AI, but I think in this case, AI...
You're smarter than AI on this case.
AI may have needed some parameters to come up with the winning. But first of all, so tell me what color it was.
So, of course, it was dark, but it looked to me like it was light color with some... with some dots, and I just want to say that when I put it on, I found out that there are people in the area who have servos, and, you know, like a woman that I know said that a friend of hers has two servos in her home, and so, you know, it could be an escaped one, though I guess that's also unlikely. But.
Well, first of all, I need to say that Larry and I have been doing this for a long, long time, longer than I care to try and figure out. And we learned a long time ago to never say never. Yeah. So we've had people citing things that they think were this or that. And when it comes down to the bottom line, they are sometimes right, even though it doesn't make any sense. And a lot of exotic animals are kept in captivity. And although, as you say, it's unlikely, it's plausible that it could have been an escaped animal that you have identified. And in this case, we'll give AI credit for what it did. But I thought where you were going with the light color and the long tail was a long-standing list of sightings we've dealt with over the years, and that's a mountain lion or cougar, which have now been documented in Wisconsin, and therefore the luster of mountain lion sightings has tarnished a little bit over time, so we hardly hear about that anymore, but it used to be pretty common. But when you describe the spots, that kind of rules that out, and the mountain lion is much larger than what you're describing, you know, three or four times the size of a bobcat, which is two or three times the size of a house cat. So we're talking about an animal that would be 6-7 feet long or more with its long tail. That's probably not what you saw. So I didn't see it. You had a pretty good description. Anything's plausible. If you want to stick with what AI and your recollection speaks to, it could have been an escape. And we've had lots of examples over the years. A few years ago, we had a sighting up near, I think it was Beaver Dam, of a wolverine, you know, which had been gone from Wisconsin for many, many years. And ultimately, that was traced to an escapee from a small game farm.
Yeah.
And so things like that happen. And Larry, you remember the... prairie dog.
Oh yeah,
out
the
by
poor prairie dog. The
poor prairie dog out by Prairie du Chien on the river, and in that case, the landowner said, "Hey, we've got a prairie dog by the barn." And I said, "No, it's probably woodchuck." And we went back and forth for a few times, and ultimately, they sent in a Polaroid snapshot, and it was a prairie dog, which had apparently arrived from the Dakotas in a load of hay. So all sorts of bottom line is. All sorts of weird stuff happens when it comes to animals because people have them in captivity, or they move them from one place to another when perhaps they shouldn't, or in some cases the animals move themselves or are moved by a storm or whatever. So who knows? I can't tell you what you saw for sure.
Esty, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. You know, it kind of reminds me of the photos and so forth that we get.
Wow.
And yeah. The Snapshot Wisconsin project is really cool when it comes to animals. We'll talk about snapshots as it comes to endangered species later at 12:30 today. But
well, that's become a big deal. You know, the whole use of camera trapping, as it's called, in other words, catching an animal's image rather than the animal itself, has become a hobby for many people, even if they're not participating formally in the Snapshot program. And anyway, Snapshot marked a big milestone a week or so ago when they logged their 10 millionth photograph logged into the system from their cooperators, distributed in a non-random pattern. I mean, they've got the cameras out where they want them so that they've got Wisconsin pretty well blanketed. And the data derived from all these literally millions of photographs have been very useful in determining species presence or absence, relative abundance, all sorts of weird stuff. They've captured some really neat photographs. So anyway, yeah. But no servals that I know of. So
no, Scott Craven, our guest. Today, Emeritus Professor of UW Extension Wildlife Ecology. And you can join in with your questions at 800-642-1234, or if you'd like, email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Looking at the world of wildlife today with Scott Craven. Great to have Scott back. And you can join in. Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234. Email to talk@WPR.org. Nick in Green Bay, we'll give you a chance. Hi, Nick.
Hi, how are you guys doing today?
Great. Appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
Scott, I love it when you're here because I think you're just an amazing guy. I decided to take the kayak out for the first time this year, and I figured I'd just take it through the Fox River here in Green Bay. I figured I wouldn't see much because it's in the urban setting, but I was extremely impressed, and I was kayaking down, and I don't want to say where, but on the Fox River, I decided to take a break, and I caught something out of the corner of my eye, and the thing caught the corner of his eye, too, and I looked up, and there's a bald eagle. My question for you is, how skittish are they? Because I took a few pictures, but the sun was kind of bleaching out my phone, so I couldn't see. But I sat there for about 10 minutes, but then I think I kind of ticked off the bald eagle, and she or he got out of the nest and started circling and squawking at me. Are they pretty skittish, or are they? Because I think,
yeah.
I assume they're not too skittish because they're just such an amazing bird.
Well, they can afford to be not particularly skittish because they're kind of at the top of the heap when it comes to birds.
Yeah.
They're big and powerful and can take care of themselves. But like any wild bird, if they're not used to people or if they're disturbed at a feeding site or a nest site or whatever else, they can become very skittish or protective of that particular turf. Also, like most animals, they can become used to people on heavily used lakes, places where they've nested for many, many years or decades. And, you know, people are constantly looking at them, taking pictures, or maybe even feeding them, which is not a recommended practice. But so there's kind of a spectrum there between, whoa, I've never seen a person before, I'm getting the heck out of here, or, oh, a person, and they've got a fishing rod. They're going to catch a fish. And if I beg appropriately, they'll throw the fish to me. And I've seen that happen, too. I see it happen regularly on the little lake that we're on in northern Wisconsin, to the point that in the case of the pair of eagles that hangs out there, they've come down and sat on the wooden bench at the end of my dock while we're standing there catching bluegills a few feet away. So there's a tremendous range of responses for eagles or any other animal when it comes to wildlife. And one other thing you brought up, don't rule out the urban environment when it comes to wildlife. The wildlife populations, particularly for species tolerant of people, are incredibly dense in urban areas, more so perhaps even in as opposed to what we'd consider wild or natural areas. When you think about things like Canada geese or raccoons, things like that, they do just fine in the urban environment. So it's a fine place to go kayaking or canoeing and actually expect to see wildlife. So have a good time out there.
Thanks, Nick. Thank you for calling. Jody in Sauk City. We'll go to you now. Hi, Jody.
I just have a question. I guess it's more gardening related, but it's also wildlife. We experienced for the first time in almost 70 years ice heaves on an inland lake at our cabin in northern Wisconsin. And now instead of a gentle walk to the lake, we had our proud owners of a bank. Is there some erosion occurring now? We've never had that before.
Did you say ice heaps?
Heaves.
Oh, ice heaves. Okay.
Okay.
Well, that's if you've got some shoreline, there are a lot of things that can affect erosion. I thought where you were headed from a wildlife angle was the undermining of banks with muskrat dens and things like that, which we get a lot of questions on. Ice heaving that occurs under certain conditions in the winter, when the wind drives sheets of ice, usually as the ice is breaking up and pushes these big slabs of ice up on shorelines, can do a lot of rearranging of the landscape because it's a powerful force. But that's just, it happens. The ice melts away, and maybe the shoreline has changed a little bit, but it can be restored if that's the issue.
Yeah, yeah. You can still, there's still things you could do to restore it, for sure. Jody, thank you. Appreciate it. Sean in Ironwood, Michigan, your turn. Hi, Sean.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. I just moved here. I don't understand bear hunting. How do you use hounds to chase a bear up a tree and then shoot the bear? How is that fair or sporting?
Well, okay. Let me try and tackle that. So at least in Wisconsin, for example, I'm more familiar with that situation. Bears are hunted in two basic ways, either with bait. So people put out bait piles with all sorts of things, usually sweet materials like a pile of Twinkies or donuts or whatever. Put out bait and then sit there in a tree stand or ground blind, wait for the bear to come in and, dinner. That's how they harvest the bear. The alternative technique is running the bears with hounds. So individuals or groups of individuals maintain enough dogs that are well trained. In fact, they're training them right now in northern Wisconsin, running bears for practice. So they come across a bear trail, either coming to bait, or they find the trail, or have a photo station where they know there's a bear around. The dogs pick up the scent. The bear is pursued. Sometimes it trees, sometimes it doesn't. And the idea there is the bear eventually is treed, then the person with the appropriate permit comes up, okay, that's a bear, that's a good-sized one, or no, it's too small, let it come down the tree and leave, it's too big, same thing. But ultimately the bear might be shot or killed, harvested, whatever term you want to use. So it's either hunting with bait or hunting with hounds. The third technique is just what's sometimes referred to in some states as fair chase or incidental harvest. No dogs, no bait. You're just out walking in the woods or sitting in a tree or incidental to some other type of hunting. You see a bear, you shoot it. That's a very low return proposition. I don't know about you, Larry, but I think of many years here in the woods in Wisconsin, and I could count on one thumb the number of bear sightings that I've actually had. So that latter technique is pretty well dismissed in favor of the baiting or hound use. They alternate each year with who gets to go first. So this year in Wisconsin, on opening day, September 3rd, the hound users get a week to hunt the bears with that technique, and then the people sitting on bait come into play a week later. Next year it'll be the reverse. After a week, everybody can do whatever they want. So your question, that's how the system is works and is divided. The issue of fair chase and is this right, wrong, or indifferent, that's the reason that I wanted to draw a permit, and I did, I think it was 3 years ago now, because I wanted to experience this. I have a place up north, and I've seen the trucks and crews tearing around with all sorts of radio antennas and dog kennels, and it's quite a production. I said I didn't know how I really felt about that, much like you. So anyway, I finally drew a permit. I said, well, I'm going to try this, and I did. And in reality, at least the group I was with, it was the whole process, putting the kill out of the picture for a moment, the whole process of a group of folks getting together and the coordination of, you know, 10 or a dozen pickup trucks and people with radios and everybody's got dogs and kennels. It was quite a production. And everybody was having it was just fun for them. Most of those people didn't have a dog in the fight, so to speak. They didn't have a bear permit. They were just out for the fun and recreation or enjoyment of running their dogs that are trained to do what they do. And if a bear was found or treed, great. If it wasn't, hey, they had a good day in the field anyway. So anyway, I was part of this. I was the person with the tag. And we ultimately, after a 3 or 4 hours of running around the woods, listening to the chatter on the radios and where the bear was headed and so forth, ultimately the bear did tree. And we can leave it at that. I did harvest the bear to complete the whole thing. And I'd have to say it was a very interesting experience. I understand now why the people involved are involved and what they get out of it. But eventually I and other people have to decide how they feel about it. And it's not without some problems. Where there's private land around, neither the bear nor the dogs know the difference between public land and private land. So some landowners get excited about hounds running bears through their property, and there are other issues like that. But if that's well managed and the hunting groups are conscientious, it has its place on the landscape, and bears are quite abundant and can cause a variety of problems. So some ability to keep a lid on the population is important. And this is, for better or for worse, this is the way it's done.
Yeah. There you go, Sean. Thank you so much for calling. Paul in Cashton will turn our attention to bumblebees and honeybees, I think.
Hi, Larry.
Hi. What's on your mind, Paul?
Well, we got a lot of flowers, and so far, almost all the bees I see on the flowers are bumblebees. And we have honeybee hives not very far from my house. And so why are we seeing all these bumblebees?
Well, that's an excellent question and a really good one for one of our entomologist friends. Now that you mention it, Paul, I have to say I was out this morning early watering my raspberries. I'm going to have a tremendous raspberry crop. The canes are, in some cases, 8 or 9 feet tall this year.
Oh, my gosh.
And they're being pollinated right now for the fall, late summer, early fall crop. And as I was trying to water them, I noticed, holy mackerel, the flowers were just covered with bees pollinating the raspberries, and every one of them was a bumblebee. And I thought to myself, well, that's odd. I wonder what kind of bumblebees these are, because there's a lot of concern about bumblebee conservation and management in the state. And I think there are bumblebee brigades and groups of people who are paying attention to which bumblebees are out there. So anyway, I don't know. I don't know enough about them to know what I was seeing, but there were a lot of them. And I'd have to say that as I've watched my apples earlier in the year and the raspberries now and the flowers around the house, I've not seen a whole lot of honeybees. All I can do, Paul, is confirm your observation and suggest that if you're really curious about this, you could email one of our entomologists on campus. I don't know if you have any of those guys on anymore, Larry. Phil Pelletier used to be a regular guest. And get an answer that way, or
PJ Leash is a regular guest too.
So maybe you can make contact that way, or call your local DNR office and say, hey, you're trying to get through to the natural heritage people and you've got a question about bumblebees, or call a local nature center and they're likely to know as well. Yeah. And get some more information that way.
And PJ Leash is on August 17th.
Well, there you go. Just 10 days away, you can get that question answered.
Yeah, there you go, Paul. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too. Open lines get you on pretty quickly. The number is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or email to talk@wpr.org. Actually, Phil, I had my dates wrong. Phil Pelletieri is on the 20th of August, so it's the 20th.
Okay.
And PJ is on in September. So, but still, August 20th, Phil Pelletieri.
A whole squadron of entomologists will address this problem.
Ken emailed, he has a farmer who has trouble with crows. They sit on top of his plastic bales, the plastic-wrapped hay bales, and poke holes in them. He believes they learn to do this to attract insects to the sweet smells which come from the fermented hay. How do you keep crows from damaging his hay?
Wow.
Man, I don't know what you do for that.
I'm just thinking about that's an interesting theory on why the crows are doing that and how they might have figured or learned that behavior. But regardless of why they're doing it, I am not surprised that they are doing it. But it seems to me that there are a couple of possible approaches. One, if this is a large array of bales, you know, the way you see them somehow lined up on a farm where there's maybe 100 or 200 bales end to end, that would be good positioning for crows are pretty skittish. And, for example, in the years when they were scaring Canada geese around Horican Marsh, they had the automatic firing propane cannons that would just periodically, every 5 minutes or 3 minutes, whatever they were set for, make a big boom, and everything would take off out of the field in question. I would think that that kind of approach might be appropriate for the crows and would probably work. Or whether there's some type of coating or spray or whatnot that could be placed on the wrapping to either reinforce it and make it impossible for them to get through it, or be offensive or repellent to the crows. Bottom line is, I think this would be a question for the USDA Wildlife Services people, either in the state office in Sun Prairie, or there's a Northern District office up in Rhinelander. And just look up USDA Wildlife Services is the technical name. And you'll get you'll find an 800 number for either of those offices. They should be able to tell you and maybe even provide some help in terms of how to deal with it.
Bill in Oregon, Wisconsin, emailed that last Saturday he was shocked to see a red squirrel on his property. He's seen hundreds of them up north, but doesn't ever recall seeing one in Dane County. Are there breeding populations of red squirrels in Dane County? He's curious if he has a chance of seeing more or if it was an unfortunate relocation.
Well, since he has some experience with red squirrels up north, I don't think there's any question about the identification here. I, too, live in Dane County. I've never seen a red squirrel in the county, but they were fairly common not too far northwest of here. For example, around the Dells along the Wisconsin River, there are lots of them. So it's certainly within the realm of possibility that they're moving around a little bit, expanding their range, or that this was an unfortunate move of the squirrel, you know, who knows how. I don't know of any breeding population in the county. And I think it's a long shot. They tend to like mixed forests with more conifers than we have here, and that's the kind of thing they inhabit in the Dells. But again, I mean, we're only 30 or 40 miles away from the population, so, hey, anything could happen.
John in Reedsburg will give you a chance. Hi, John.
Howdy, Larry. So you guys had a question about crows picking through plastic bales or on top of silage. I'm a veterinarian that works with farmers in this area, and I've had several farmers use this technique to great success for making crows not do that. What they'll do is they'll selectively harvest one or two crows, and they'll take the carcass and put it on top of the plastic, either bales or silage bag, and it's very good repellent. When the crows see that there's a dead one there, they actually vacate the area pretty quickly.
Well, I was aware of that technique. Used to use it in my younger days back in New England where you wanted something, you know, protected. In young Christmas trees, for example, when the crows would land on the leader and break that off and disfigure the trees, used to shoot a crow and hang it on a stick, and that seemed to work pretty well. It's not, not perhaps a popular technique in the public eye, but if it works, there is a crow season, so it's legal to shoot a crow, and that may be somewhat of a challenge in and of itself, but hey, if that works and you've seen it work, there you go.
John, thank you for calling. Appreciate it. Let's turn to Mary in Lebanon. Hi, Mary.
Hi. I'm calling to say that I have a pair of great crested flycatchers, and I have an immature one that lands on my deck and spreads his wings. I know that my husband used to say they would spread their wings in the sun because of the lice bothering them.
Could be.
So is that what it does? It lands on the deck and then spreads its wings?
Yes, it does. And right now he's on, I have a rail, like a pole that goes out that hangs a hummingbird feeder. And right now there are two great crested flycatchers right here by my deck on the railings.
Oh, that's cool. I mean, in terms of any bird spreading its wings, there are other explanations besides the parasites. So you get the morning dew and the bird's a little damp and will spread the wings to the morning sun and dry out the way some marine or aquatic birds do. So I think there are a number of plausible explanations, but it's a cool bird to have around the deck. So
yeah,
good luck with it.
Yeah, thanks, Mary. Appreciate the call. Scott Craven, our guest today, emeritus professor and UW Extension wildlife ecologist. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you with us here on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. We're looking at the world of wildlife with Scott Craven. Great to have Scott back. And we'll go right back to the phones here. Jeff in Pelican Lake, we'll go to you next. Hi, Jeff.
Oh, I love your program. It's always interesting. I had an opportunity to visit Madison and go on a tour of the Capitol. And, of course, when you go there, you want to go up in the dome as high as you can and take a look around. So we got up there, and we're looking around, and I said, well, what's that over there? And the guy says, well, that's a coyote decoy. And I said, you got a quite... quite a few of them up here. He says, we got five or six of them. We have them up there to keep the seagulls and the crows and the pigeons off the roof.
It's a common technique you can use for geese, too. Anyway, you can buy a coyote decoy easily and then use it in a bird control application. But you can get all sorts of other things. You can get a floating alligator head and coyote decoys. And anything that might scare the birds away is used.
I didn't know
they were up on the Capitol, but hey, if
it
works.
I haven't been up there for a while, so that's cool. Thanks, Jeff, for calling. Ron in Weyerhaeuser, your turn. Hi, Ron.
Yeah, hi, Larry. Hey, Scott. I was just calling to add on a little to what Scott was talking with the lady earlier about the ice heaving. I always thought that it was something that occurred late in the winter when the ice was going out. I went up to our cabin on Lake Amicagon after ice out, and we had a big heave, way bigger than normal. And I just assumed it was from ice out. But one of the other cabin owners said, no, this heaving actually occurred when the lake was completely froze over in the middle of January. And come to find out that if you get the right conditions where you get really cold weather in shallow water, like along the shoreline, the ice can freeze and refreeze if you get the right conditions where it's freezing and thawing and freezing and thawing. We had a very cold and no snow on top of the ice.
Yeah.
The ice will actually expand and just push the shoreline up and heave it, ice jacking, it's called. I looked into it. It was unbelievable how much damage it did. Some of the people that had riprap along the shore, it was almost like a bulldozer. It just pushed way up into their property, chipped trees. It was pretty incredible, and it happened right during the middle of winter.
Well, now that you mention it, I remember in my days, I used to be an avid perch fisherman on Lake Mendota, and of course, ice is a very dynamic thing. You'd be sitting out there on your bucket, and all of a sudden, on a really cold day, a pressure crack would occur, and you'd hear this tremendous roar, and all of a sudden, a big crack appears in 2 feet of ice, and the ice is shifting with that pressure change. And even along a pressure crack where it cracks, sometimes the ice will move up so that there were slabs of ice resting on top of the other, kind of like the geological movement of plates in the Earth's crust, where it shifts and moves and piles up on each other. So, well, good comment. I guess it's not just related to
spring
ice out.
Yeah, you're right. Ron, thanks. Appreciate that call. Let's go to Diane in Lake Mills next. Hi, Diane.
Good morning, Larry and Steve. I have an issue with a female cardinal. She's continuously banging and coming up and crashing into my kitchen windows. And so I put up some little butterfly stickers all over the windows, and I have some glass jars and paraphernalia sitting on the windowsills. And I know it's a female, and I don't know why. She's been doing this for at least a month.
Well, this is birds crashing into windows is more of a spring phenomenon, but it's associated usually with the nesting period. But some of these birds will have second broods, second nests, and so forth. And it's often a territorial thing. It's more often males, actually, because they see their reflection in the window, and then they attack it, thinking it's a competing male in their territory. And robins are particularly prone to do it, but cardinals as well, and there are others. And they'll just bang into the window constantly for hours on end, and it's very annoying and can mess up the window. So I understand the problem. It is a little unusual this time of year, and it's a little unusual that it's a female, but whatever her motivation, now cardinals are seed eaters, so in some cases, in seasons that aren't the breeding season, birds that are interested in insects or spiders will fly into a window to pick something off the screen or the window. But I think this is a case where the female may have a nest nearby, and for whatever reason, she's spending some time attacking her reflection. The stars and glassware and so forth may help, but if you really want to, if it's one particular window that you can identify, you can solve the problem completely by draping a piece of plastic bird netting that any garden store has in sheets, draping that down from above the window with a little spacer and attaching it so that there's an inch or two of space between the net and the window, and then she can't get to the window, regardless of her motivation. And this stuff is very fine black mesh, so you can still use the window, see through it and whatnot. And when the problem goes away, you can take that down. You can cover the window with a variety of things as well, but that may make it difficult to use or enjoy the window, especially if it's in your kitchen. So the netting works well. And other things, some of the bird scare devices that have come up, like pinwheels, streamers, plastic balloons that some of the garden centers sell, like it's called scare eye balloons. Those can be suspended or hung near the window on the outside, and those are usually enough to deter the bird as well. So, and you can Google it and probably come up with all sorts of information on bird strikes on windows, and use some of the same tactics that are designed to actually protect birds from hitting windows when they're just flying around feeders or on other buildings. So
there you go.
I think you can take care of it, and the cardinal can go about his business safely.
Diane, thank you so much for calling. Again, you can join us. Open lines at 800-642-1234. Email to talk at WPR.org. Jim Call couldn't stay with us. He's in the middle of nowhere, and he has problems with squirrels digging little holes in his yard. Anything he could do? Little holes.
Well, they're either burying or digging up nuts, but it's a common thing, and it's largely cosmetic. It probably isn't going to cause any problem for the turf in the long run. So maybe on the one hand, it's a matter of tolerance. On the other hand, you can't cover the lawn. I don't think there's anything that I know of that you can treat the lawn with that's going to bother the squirrels. And you could get vindictive and say, okay, that's it. I'm taking out some squirrels. Whether you use live traps, you're in the country, whatever technique you use. But I'll just warn you that, and we used to talk about this, Larry, but you know, that the number of squirrels that are around the typical urban or suburban home or whatever is staggering. And the old expression, nature abhors a vacuum, applies. So you go to a lot of trouble to catch and remove squirrels and relocate them, whatever you're going to do with them. And they just keep coming. And I go way back to the days when we had that information from one of our horticulture buddies who was not very happy about squirrels around his home here in Madison because of his fruit tree plantings. And he and his neighbor operated two Have a Heart live traps 24/7 around the clock. And he averaged, this is over years, and his average of the number of squirrels he removed over time was 155 squirrels a year, and it just kept going. Bottom line is, you can fight the battle, but you won't win the war. And I think this is a case where you grin and bear it and walk around with a hoe if the holes are substantial enough. You know, walk around either with a bucket of soil and put a little soil in them, or use a hoe to just put them back together again. And realize that this is a seasonal thing, and it's going to be over here in a month or two.
Kim in Milwaukee, what's on your mind?
Hi, yeah. So there was the deep tunnel project near us. I live about 3/4 of a mile from the lake, and since then we've seen, like, some rat activity in our backyard, and we have a person come over who's, like, made sure our property doesn't have any nests or anything. He set some traps, but we're still seeing an occasional, like, rat run through. So he's thinking that maybe there's a nest in one of the properties near us. So I was wondering if there's any decoy or anything that we could use just to keep from, you know, the rats from running through our yard.
Now, these are Norway rats, as in the rats that you see in urban areas, not muskrats.
Oh, correct, yes.
Yeah.
Well, I think whoever was there and inspected the property might have suggested some baits, tamper-proof bait stations that could have been put along your foundation, or you could just have some traps out as a matter of as a routine thing in case a rat's passing through. But in some urban areas, rats, Norway rats, as Larry mentioned, are incredibly abundant, and if they're displaced by some activity like the construction activity you described, you know, they'll be around for a while but will settle down somewhere. They're a part of urban living, and very difficult to deal with, and they're incredibly prolific. So they you know, they mentioned a nest nearby. A nest could be just about anywhere, and they will have 8 or 9 litters per year, 11 or 12 young per litter. You know, you do the math, they can just be, much like the fellow squirrels who just called, they're incredibly prolific. And this strikes me as being potentially a neighborhood issue. And if there's a neighborhood association or group of homeowners or just a few friends that get together and say, hey, are you seeing rats? And most people won't talk about it because there's a kind of a stigma associated with rats, so they may not say. But if all of a sudden you get people, oh, yeah, we see a rat occasionally, well, then operating on a neighborhood basis or a city block or whatever is going to be more productive in the long run than just what you might do in your backyard. So,
yeah, all good points.
And, yeah, and there are plenty of good commercial pest control operators who could help you out.
And Kim, good luck, and thank you so much for calling. Scott Craven, our guest today, and he will be with us right up until 12:30 today. In the meantime, we're going to take a quick look at the news, and Treble and Lodi and Christy and Dane County will be getting to you after this look at the news. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR. We're taking a look at the world of wildlife on the show today with our guest, Scott Craven. I'm Larry Mueller. Scott, of course, a retired UW Extension wildlife ecologist. Questions for him? I hope you'll join in. The number is 800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. And Treble from Lodi has been waiting a bit, so let's go to Treble. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi, Larry. I'm calling because I'm a little disturbed by, with respect to your guest, by what he says about having fun running around in pickup trucks killing bears in northern Wisconsin, where people shouldn't be running around in pickup trucks harassing wildlife. And I just think about what Aldo Leopold says in his writings about the negativity of hunting animals that are have as much a right to exist as any other living thing.
Well, I, you know, it's well understood and well known that there's a tremendous spectrum of public opinions about a variety of things, including hunting, from relatively vehement anti-hunting sentiment to being an avid participant and everything in between. In terms of public support overall, generally speaking, all of the national surveys for quite a few years have suggested that the public does support recreational hunting at the 75 or 80% level in lots of national surveys. And I wonder about the American public agreeing on anything at the 80% level. So the reality is support is good, but it depends on how the question is phrased. If the question is, do you support hunting because people utilize the meat for food, support is very high. If you ask the question about supporting hunting if the goal is just pursuing a trophy, or if it's billed as strictly, hey, this is, you know, fun, whatever, then support is lower. And everybody has to decide where they fit on the spectrum. Leopold, of course, was an avid hunter himself. He was involved in the early days of the development of archery hunting with what we would consider very primitive equipment these days, and handmade some of his bows, and we have a couple of his bows in the collection in the wildlife department here that he started. But anyway, he was an avid hunter, both archery in terms of deer and upland birds. But he took a philosophical and very sensitive view toward it, and of course wrote about things like in the Fierce Green Fire, the killing of a wolf in the Southwest and getting to the animal before it was actually deceased, and watching that fierce green fire in its eyes snuff out. And, you know, that is something that even amongst people who hunt, like myself, that kind of thing is a real gut check in terms of, do I want to do this again? In the case of the pursuing bears, again, that's one of the ways, as I described earlier, one of the ways that it's done. And the people who participate literally do have a great time. That's what they do. Every Saturday, those guys get together in this particular group, and there are many groups scattered across northern Wisconsin. That's what they do. And personally, they're not killing a bear in the process, but somebody may. But for them, it's the pursuit and the chase. And that's why I participated once to see how I felt about it. And to realize that, well, you know, maybe some of these things, it's not your cup of tea, but it gets somebody else pretty excited. Well, okay, to each his own. Some people like to smoke. Some people like to drink. Some people are doing all sorts of things that other people think is not a good idea. I mean, look at the controversy, for example, with wake boats in the state right now. So you know, this is kind of a conversation that's interesting and people can get involved with it, but everybody decides where they fit on the spectrum, and pursuits that are legal and that people participate in because they enjoy it, well, okay. Doesn't mean you have to do it or I have to do it, but some people do.
Let's take a call from Christy in Dane County next. Hi, Christy.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. We live in a small 40-home subdivision a couple miles from the Madison city limits. It is wooded. And this year we've had more deer damage to our yard than usual. We do have a fence around the garden, but it isn't 8 feet. It's probably only about 4 feet. And they just hop in and hop out and have eaten the spinach and Swiss chard and lettuce and green beans and beets and taken the tops off tomatoes. You get the idea. They've eaten the leaves off my hosta. Impatience. And I mean, hosta literally right next to the house under a deck.
Yeah.
It sounds like total devastation. I don't mean to make light of it. Larry and I are both avid gardeners. I've got a big garden outside Madison, and I do have it fenced. But the deer are a constant concern. They occasionally hop over the fence into my small orchard and do some damage to the trees and whatnot. So I'm sensitive to it, but it's not an easy thing to deal with. How big, the garden that's fenced, how big would you say that is? 50 by 50, 10 by 10?
50 by 20.
Okay, so a little bit smaller than my, generally speaking, the smaller the area enclosed, the shorter the fence you can get away with. And I'm surprised to see that they're jumping freely into a garden that size. But again, if you're in a neighborhood and the deer are used to people and they're hungry and they see all that good stuff in the garden, they can easily jump the fence, as you have witnessed. You can, and that's unfortunate because a fence is kind of the line in the sand that will usually protect things. You could, if you have, depending on the size of the poles or posts that are supporting the fence, you could enlarge or increase the height, the effective height, with some wire strands as kind of outriggers strung around the perimeter of the garden. So let's say, or you could add something to your posts. So if the fence is 4 or 5 feet, you go up 8 inches, 10 inches, 12 inches, string a wire around it. Go up another 12 inches, string another wire, and hang some flagging tape on that so that the wire is visible, and you can increase the effective height of the fence. Now, you have to be a little careful because if they're used to jumping it, they may make the attempt and they can get tangled up, and that's happened to me as well with the deer suspended from my wire, and got to go out and grab the thing and release it. So you have to be a little bit careful with that. I don't have a great deal of faith in repellents, especially during the growing season like this, where they have to be reapplied constantly.
You've got some good.
I think you've got to work a little harder on the exclusion tactic, the fencing, and the covering of the hostas and whatnot. And again, much like an earlier caller who was talking about rats, sometimes this is a neighborhood issue. If you're in a little rural subdivision, chances are everybody's having the same problem. And if that's the case, then you can get together and either think about some sort of a community constructed fence or some attempt if you're embedded in areas that's undeveloped, either agricultural or wooded, do something that would put more hunting pressure on those animals and perhaps reduce the numbers that way. I don't know what your situation. Did you say you were in Dane County?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. The I'm on the Dane County Citizens Deer Advisory Committee that kind of looks at what's going on in the county and who's having problems or who wants more deer, less deer, or whatever else. And this is the kind of thing we discuss with that group. Can you give me some idea of what segment of the county you're in, west, north, southwest, or what town?
Town of Cottage Grove.
Oh, okay. So you're actually a little bit east of Madison. Do you know if you're in? Do you know anything about the deer hunting or deer management scene? So you'd know if you're in the what's called the metro zone for Dane County.
Some of our neighbors do hunt on some of the farmland that's nearby.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's shotgun. Is that what's allowed in Dane County? Okay.
Well, actually, shotguns used to be the only thing you could use, but now rifles are perfectly legal anywhere in Dane County. But in a situation like that, often archery hunting is preferred by the neighbors because it's quiet and unobtrusive and can harvest. Good bow hunters can take quite a few deer. So that's one approach, is to try and go after the root of the problem, which is an abundant deer herd. But that's a chronic issue in Dane County. And we issue literally thousands of deer permits, or authorize thousands of deer permits in Dane County that go unused because access is very difficult here in an urbanized county like we live in. So it's hard for would-be hunters who would willingly take the deer to get access to where they are. And I guess this is, rather than occupy the rest of our time, if you want to email me your phone number or something or whatever, I can give you a call and we could talk about this a little bit because of my work on the Deer Committee. If you think that would help, or you know, we can see, I can look on an aerial photo or an app like Onyx and see where you are and what's around you in terms of the ability to put a little more pressure on the deer. But you as an individual have to take the basic steps of exclusion or repellence or whatnot to do what you can, but it's not an easy proposition.
Hmm. There you go, Christy. And the deer management unit, is there a website or anything for that, Scott?
If she goes to the DNR website and looks up what are called the CDACs, the Citizen Deer Advisory Committees, she can find the Dane County Committee, and I'll be listed there as a member with my contact information.
Christy, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Bob in Medford has a question, I believe. Let's go there. Hi, Bob.
Good afternoon. I have a question here about badgers. The other day I had one in the backyard here kind of rooting up my yard. And the best question is, how do I get rid of them humanely? I may add that.
Well, first of all, with an issue like this, we always make sure we're dealing with the right animal. Now, a badger with its black and white face and pretty big animal, not likely to be mistaken for anything else. You're absolutely sure of what you're seeing?
Yes, it was in the daylight hours, and I didn't know at first. I thought it was a groundhog, and then he lifted his head, and sure enough, there's the old white stripe between the eyes there.
Okay. Well, I mean, woodchuck is the common confusion point, but if you see the white striping on the face, then okay, it is a badger, and Dane County is one of the counties that has a pretty good population. There was just an article in the I think it was an Outdoor News about a group of students at UW-Milwaukee who had been spending years collecting information on badgers in the state, where they were, what they were doing, and so forth. Usually this is a case where you need somebody who knows what they're doing and has the equipment to catch it and move it. so that it's no longer your problem. They're a protected animal. It's not like with a woodchuck where you have the right as property owner to poke a shotgun out the window and put an end to it. But there are a number of people within the Wisconsin Trappers Association who will help out with problems like this and catch the animal. There are also commercial operations like critter control and other types of pest control businesses that help with wildlife issues that could perhaps also capture it. But I think the best thing to do is contact the local DNR wildlife manager. And we're in Dane County, right?
No, I am on the verge of Taylor Price.
Oh, okay. All right. So you're a ways away. Same situation. I'd still go start out with the local DNR wildlife manager. You can find that off the DNR's website and make contact with them and say, hey, I got a problem with a badger here. Is there somebody you can recommend locally who might come and remove it for me? And see where that takes you. Because they're a big, powerful animal. They're not that easy to catch. They're not that pleasant to handle.
No.
Unlike dealing with a squirrel that anybody could catch in a have-a-heart trap and deal with, catching a badger is a different proposition. And that's why I think you should go with someone who knows what they're doing. So
yeah.
Start with the wildlife manager locally and see where you get.
Good luck, Bob. Thank you so much for calling. William in Medford emailed us. He has William has bats in the roof of his porch. If he does the needed repairs in the fall, would he be disturbing them?
That depends on whether or not they overwinter in the building. If he's pretty sure that they depart, never hears any scratching or seeing any sign of them, then the work can be done after the cold season drives them into hibernation, and that shouldn't be an issue. If he wants to do it sooner than that, depending on the access they have, if it's in an ideal case, oh, there's one hole or one crack that could be treated with a bat excluder, a device like a one-way door, so to speak, that can be fabricated to cover a lot of applications so the bats can go out but can't get back in, then that's another alternative to allow the work to be done a little sooner. But if it's a porch, chances are it's so cold that they do leave for warmer quarters. And therefore, once we've had a couple good hard freezes, there's no more flying insects as a food source, then he's probably okay to do the repairs.
Jim in Madison emailed while in Milwaukee near the South Shore a couple of weeks ago. He was taking some photos of blue angels, and this is something Scott and I have already discussed. The blue angels were practicing for their show, and he snapped a shot and was amazed that he'd captured what he thought was an owl in the same frame, and it must have flushed from a nearby porch and wonders what it might be. It's too hard for us to tell, but you had some good idea. You had a good piece of advice.
We've been looking at it here for since the 12 o'clock hour in report, and I can't figure out. It's a matter of perspective. The bird is about the same size as a Blue Angel fighter plane because of the perspective. So it's hard to tell whether it's a small bird really close to the photographer or a big bird between the plane and the photographer. So I can't tell. It doesn't look like an owl to me.
No, me either.
But again, without the right perspective, I simply can't tell. But armed with the photograph, which obviously can be electronically sent these days, you could send that to one of the nature centers in Milwaukee or the Audubon Society group.
Cornell.
Or the Cornell Ornithology Lab, eBird. And you can find that easily enough on the internet. And if you email this to them and say, what the heck is this? You'll get your answer.
I'm pretty sure you will. It's hard for us to tell, but a really cool picture.
It is.
A really cool picture.
It's either a really small plane or a really big bird.
Karina emailed to ask why, at this time of the year, baby birds are still in their nests, not yet fledged, and why the baby deer still have their spots. She thought babies were born in spring and birds don't have multiple clutches. Have you observed this as well?
We'll take the fawns first. The birth of fawns is a spectrum of fawns from sometimes as early as, I remember one report, Easter, all the way through summer, depending on when the fawn was when the doe was bred and so forth. The peak is around the first week of June, but it's a bell curve. There's early ones and there's late ones. Mm-hmm. So there'll be spotted fawns yet for some time. Even fawns born during that peak rush in early June are still spotted. So that's just a matter of when the fawns were born. The bird situation, then there are certainly baby birds still around. I don't know what kind of bird she's referring to. Some birds are late nesters by nature, but many birds will have a second or third brood if they lose their nest, lose their clutch, whatever. And so there could be young birds of just about any species still around. It's just like the little geese we see running, or ducks running around in the pond.
Yeah.
There are big ones, and whoa, those little fuzzy ones look like they just hatched. Well, they did. So
there you go. Well, I wanted to mention the waterfowl festival in Oshkosh that's coming up. You know,
I think it's the 22nd of August, something
22nd
like that.
22nd and 23rd. And quite a festival.
It's become the thing to go to if you're interested in duck hunting or waterfowl in general. And the state duck calling competition is part of it. And this decoy car, all sorts of stuff related to ducks, geese, and waterfowl. So something somebody might want to attend.
Well, Scott, it's always a pleasure. And you'll be back in a couple of months and likely, and we'll do this up over again. It's always a pleasure. Thank you, Scott.
I think I'll be back in October, so we'll see what happens.
All right. Scott Craven, our guest today, emeritus professor and emeritus UW Extension wildlife ecologist. Always great to have him with us. And he will, he will be back again, and we'll talk some more with him. Coming up next, we're going to talk about some citizen scientists around the state who participate in the Aquatic Invasive Species Snapshot Day coming up this Saturday. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. You know, every August, volunteers across Wisconsin gather to monitor dozens of Wisconsin water bodies. It's called the Aquatic Invasive Species Snapshot Day, and it's happening again this Saturday. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Emily Heald, who's a Rivers Outreach Specialist for the Aquatic Invasive Species Program of UW Extension's Natural Resources Institute. Emily coordinates the Aquatic Invasive Species Snapshot Day and does it in partnership with the Wisconsin DNR, Department of Natural Resources. Do you live near a lake or a stream? Is it a healthy habitat for fish and waterfowl? Do you know how to identify invasive aquatic species? Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Emily Heald, welcome. Thanks for taking time to be with us today.
Thanks, Larry. It's fun to be here.
Let's talk some more about what the event is all about.
Mm-hmm.
Snapshot implies taking photos, but it's not that kind of snapshot.
Yeah, well, there are photos involved. Oh,
of course.
If people think they find anything, they take photos. But it's more of like a quick snapshot in time of the state of aquatic invasive species in Wisconsin.
And how do you define aquatic invasive species?
Aquatic invasive species, those are plants and animals that they're usually non-native to our area. They're introduced and they may negatively impact habitat or wildlife, recreation, the economy. They can be very costly to manage. And oftentimes this looks like disrupting the food web, outcompeting native species for habitat and for food.
Okay, so which ones are causing the most, the biggest problems in our Wisconsin waterways?
It's funny. That's the question I always get as soon as we start talking about aquatic invasive species. But it's really tough to rank them. That's why for this event, we have a whole series of aquatic invasive species that site leaders, our local site leaders, can teach people how to identify, and they choose the ones that are most locally relevant. So a species of concern in one part of the state, you know, that species might not necessarily be established in another part of the state.
Yeah. So what do you hope people get out of this event by participating?
Yeah, there are a lot of really great outcomes from this event. You know, first and foremost, people are getting that outreach and education component, just learning about what aquatic invasive species are, being able to identify them. You know, even if they come away from the event not remembering exactly how to identify something, feeling empowered that if they notice something that looks a little bit out of place, they know where to go to report it. It also gives a lot of really great information to the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources and our conservation partners about the spread of aquatic invasive species or catching them early if they're new to an area. And then there's also a really great emotional component to the event. We do a lot of feedback surveys for our volunteers after the event, and they always report feeling really great about helping the environment. They say that they enjoy meeting people with similar interests and seeing new water bodies. So there are a lot of really great outcomes with the event.
How'd they get started, this event?
So this event, we're in our 12th year right now, and it started in 2014. It was originally coordinated by the fabulous organization Wisconsin River Alliance,
mm-hmm.
and they coordinated it for a really long time. It started initially as a way to increase monitoring efforts on rivers and streams. There was initially a lot of focus on lakes. And the event was actually originally called Bridge Snapshot Day because bridge crossings on streams are areas where folks are most likely to go to dump aquariums that might have species that could become invasive. And the event has grown hugely since then, and UW-Madison Division of Extension took over coordination in 2021. And we still have a lot of the great same partners across the state as we had before. We're still partnering very closely with the Wisconsin DNR, too.
So it's pretty cool. How did you get involved in all? I mean, what's your background and how did you?
Yeah, I've been working with invasive species since grad school back, you know, about 10 years ago. And I started more in the science realm of things. I was working with rainbow smelt in northern Wisconsin. And as part of that, we did a lot of outreach. And I realized that I really love teaching people about aquatic invasive species and kind of seeing those light bulb moments of people, you know, gaining new perspectives and becoming interested in things in different ways. So I've made a career out of teaching aquatic invasive species. Now I'm really happy about it.
Well, let's talk. How many volunteers typically are you going to get?
Last year we had 159 participants. This year it's looking like it's going to grow more than that. And they're from all over Wisconsin, from all parts of the state. We have urban sites, we have really rural sites, and yeah, they come from all over.
That is a very, very cool. And let's talk about the participation part of it. Can you still register to be...
Yep, definitely. So the event is Saturday, August 9th, and registration is open until noon on Friday, August 8th. Our site leaders need a little bit of time to prepare for how many people are coming.
Sure. And what happens when somebody shows up then?
So there are over 25 sites across the state to choose from. So people can find a site near them for a training location. And once the volunteer arrives at the site, there will be a local site leader, usually there from a county conservation department, land and water, or some sort of nonprofit like a watershed group, nature center, friends group. And the site leader will teach the volunteers how to identify a small handful of locally relevant aquatic invasive species and how to monitor for them. And then after that, the volunteers will fan out to local monitoring sites to search for those aquatic invasive species. They take pictures, they grab samples, and they bring them back to the training site to be verified by the site leader.
And then do they pull them out, go back and pull them out, or what do they do?
In some cases, it depends on what the population of the aquatic invasive species is looking like. If it's a new detection and maybe it's a plant, then it's totally possible in a lot of cases to go back and remove those and manage that population effectively. Or if it's an invasive species, something like an invasive snail or an invasive mussel, those are difficult, if not impossible, to fully remove from a system, but knowing about it sooner than later helps us to really ramp up education and outreach efforts in that area so that things don't spread.
Yeah. How do you keep that? I mean, if you got something like snails, I mean, what can be done?
How do you keep them contained? Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you can't remove them, but you're focusing more on containing and education and outreach at that point. And so people can participate in things like the Clean Boats, Clean Waters program. That's through Extension Lakes. That's where folks are stationed at boat landings, and they can educate people using the water as they come and go about the importance of cleaning gear that they're using in the water so that they're not spreading things around. Because those little snails, they can get stuck in your shoes. They're stuck in mud that you might be carrying around on your equipment. And so
stuck on a boat.
Exactly. Yep. You can do different signage efforts, put up interpretive signs at water access points too.
Yeah, I've seen them. Mm-hmm. You can join in, too, with a question. The number is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or email. Maybe you've been involved in this already and want to comment on it. Love to hear from that as well, 800-642-1234. John in Sturgeon Bay, we'll go to you. Hi, John.
Hi, Larry. I wanted to ask your guest whether she could give us an update on the latest techniques and approaches that we have for removing aquatic invasive species. My particular interest in Sturgeon Bay is curly-leaf pondweed and Eurasian water milfoil, but I've been involved in surveying lakes for 20 years now, and it just becomes more and more and more pervasive and a huge problem for recreational boaters in the littoral zone.
Yeah. What do you think, Emily?
I have a couple different thoughts on that. The species that were mentioned, Eurasian water milfoil, curly leaf pondweed, those can be really tough to manage. Curly leaf pondweed produces these reproductive structures that are called turions. And once those fall into the sediment, they can stay viable for over 7 years. So it's a really tough one to manage because even if you remove the plant, you can't be sure that you're removing all of those little viable structures that are in the sediment. So that's a really tough one. There are different types of chemical treatments that have been used for Eurasian water milfoil and curly leaf pondweed in the past. A lot of times we try not to use those very much because there can be negative impacts on other life in the water. But early detection of those is really useful so that you can go and do manual removal. It's kind of like weeding a garden underwater. It's actually pretty fun to snorkel down and remove aquatic invasive plants. If things start to get really overgrown, that's a really tough one because, you know, you don't want to keep dumping chemicals into the water over time. Sometimes it can be tough to continually hand harvest and pull things. And so sometimes you're met with just kind of having to learn to live with things and learn to be in balance with things in different ways and accepting what's going on in different systems. And so that can look like aquatic weed harvesters. We see those in the Madison area a lot. That's kind of like cutting the grass through through an aquatic system so that boats and other people recreating can use the area. Also, a lot of times we tend to see these species ebb and flow quite a bit. So if they seem like they're really aggressive one year and taking over time, we can see that they start to play a little bit more nicely and integrate themselves into a system.
Yeah, interesting. John, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. Scott in Racine will give you a chance to join in. Hi, Scott.
Hi, Larry, and compliments to Emily. You've got a gift for explaining things in a way that everyone can understand. It's been very interesting. My question is a little different. My daughter is has a passion for wildlife ecology. She's headed off to college, and I am curious as to your opinion of kind of the career opportunities and the job market and kind of the overall career picture for what you do.
Yeah, that's a good question. Being in college, you know, you always start kind of at that intern level, you know, and getting as much experience as you can. I'm honestly not super in touch with that job market right now, just because I don't work with that age group as much anymore. But there's so many opportunities, and there's so many different types of listservs that you can be on to find those job opportunities. Volunteering is a really good one. I know, you know, not getting paid isn't always fun, but the experience is usually really worthwhile. Asking your professors if they have any projects that you can help volunteer on. Ask them if they know anyone else that needs a hand, and just kind of slowly work your way up from there. Mm-hmm. The more experience that you can get doing a lot of different things and build that passion and find what really interests you, I think that, you know, getting that experience and then getting that passion are things that really set people apart in the job market.
Yeah. I was thinking about my daughter, who is a year out from graduation, or has graduated, but her professor had some contacts within the DNR, and mm-hmm. she wound up on a summer internship on water quality, mm-hmm. and both water and fish. So she was doing both, and it was you know, a good 8-week project that looked pretty good on her resume. Among mm-hmm. other, I mean, she did other internships as well, but that was one that was useful. So I like your idea about the professor, but also places like the DNR mm-hmm. or other organizations.
Nature centers are always looking for volunteers.
Yeah, and even some of the earlier groups, the water-related groups, for example, that you mentioned, probably are looking for volunteers or interns.
Yes, definitely.
So she should probably be directing. She may direct her attention in those ways too.
Yep.
And the market, you never know about the market.
It's hard to predict that one. Yeah.
So Scott, a good luck to your daughter, and thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Emily Heald, our guest today, Rivers Outreach Specialist for the Aquatic Invasive Species Program of UW Extension's Natural Resources Institute. We're talking about this snapshot day that is coming up Saturday, August 9th, so coming right up now. She's coordinating the event where you would have a chance to go out and look for unwanted plants and animals in lakes and streams in your neck of the woods. So no matter where you are in the state, you can become involved. You can join in, number 800-642-1234, email to talk at WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you along today on WPR News as we talk with Emily Heald about the snapshot day as we look for aquatic invasive species around the state. The day is coming up this Saturday, and you can participate if you'd like. Grayson Nuglaris has a comment for us, I believe. Let's go there. Hi, Grace.
Hey, Larry. Thanks for the show, as usual. This is to the last caller, Scott, whose daughter is heading off for wildlife ecology. I think, you know, Larry, you and I have talked several times over the last 20 years, and I went the whole route of BS, MS, and I piled it higher and deeper. And a couple of things I have to recommend to the young woman is that, number one, volunteer with every professor you can for any project you can, no matter if it's filing stuff. Make sure you take your statistics classes and do well. Take a couple of accounting classes, because if you get to project management stage, you need to know how to properly manage funds and keep track of them. Develop some other skills. Writing skills are very, very, very important. Take even some journalism classes. Take a couple of art classes. Take a photography class. Because just as these folks are out documenting invasive aquatic species and taking snapshots, photographs, yes, they really are valuable. And it can take you, it adds to your skill set. It makes you more attractive to employers. And I dealt with aquatic invasive species because I dealt a lot with the type E botulism outbreaks on the Great Lakes and the zebra mussels and the round gobies. So, yeah, I know a little bit about those lovely aquatic invasive species.
Grace, thank you so much for calling. It sounds like good advice there, Emily.
Definitely. And I like that she hit on the volunteer aspect, because what better way to advance your career than to participate in Snapshot Day?
Yeah, absolutely. Pat in Manitowoc, we'll go to you. Hi, Pat.
Hi. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Okay. For the fellows whose daughter was looking for internships in Racine, the Parkside University south of Racine towards Kenosha has two projects. One is the Pike River Reclamation Project, and the other one is a project to save the Endeavor Endangered Rusty Patch Bee.
At UW Parkside. So there's a couple of opportunities there, again, for, well, anybody who's interested, in an internship opportunity.
Definitely. We have great partners over by Racine at UW Parkside. We also partner quite a bit with UW Sea Grant, and they have a lot of opportunities for young folks there, too. People of all ages, of course.
Yeah. And you were breaking up a little bit there, Pat, but I certainly appreciate very much your call. Are there opportunities then? I'm wondering what the DNR officials do when they learn a spot where the aquatics invasives are found.
For a new discovery, early detection. It really depends on the species, kind of like what we talked about earlier, since some of them, the removal efforts can be quite difficult, if not impossible. So those are the instances. Say you found a new population, maybe of New Zealand mud snail that we're seeing in the southern part of the state. Then that would be an opportunity to really start forming partnerships with local advocacy groups, local conservation groups, to ramp up those education and outreach efforts, making sure that people that are using those waters know that that invasive species is in there and how they can prevent spreading them. And then it also gives the conservation groups and those professionals more ability to study those populations, learn about how quickly their population numbers might increase, how they may be interacting with other native species. But sometimes those early detections, those new discoveries of aquatic invasive species can be things like purple loosestrife. That's a wetland invasive species. We say it likes to keep its feet wet. It doesn't grow in the water. It'll grow next to it. If you find a couple purple loosestrife plants, those are really easy to just dig up, pull out, and come back next year and see if anything's resprouting. But some of those things can be really easy to manage.
Yeah. I'm sure, and maybe you can comment on them, there are some common aquatic plants that people would be surprised to learn are invasive and detrimental to the environment. Give us some examples of those.
I think it probably just depends where you are in the state and what you're used to seeing. So in urban areas, we see a lot of species that a caller mentioned earlier of Eurasian water milfoil and curly leaf pondweed. in an urban area or areas that are really frequently visited by boats, it's pretty common to go to a boat landing and look off the pier and see those growing in the water. And, you know, everyone thinks of everything that grows in a lake as just weeds. And some of them are. Some of them are aquatic invasive species. But there's also a lot of really beautiful native plants that are in the water that people can learn to appreciate, too.
Yeah. Aren't there some, like, lilies? Water lily?
Yeah.
What are some of those?
White water lilies, those are native, yep. And those are really pretty. I just saw some blooming the other day. They have a big, gorgeous white flower. If you want to learn to appreciate aquatic plants, I think the best way is to go into the water and snorkel around. You don't have to swim necessarily through the plant beds. I know people don't like those touching their feet, but just swim next to them. They're so beautiful. When the light goes through them, it looks like stained glass, and that's where all the animals hang out. You can see so many fish and invertebrates. It's really an amazing world under the water.
I was trying to remember, I saw a video of a woman who had been planting a certain type of, I thought it was a lily, water lily, but it might have been a different one, and realized suddenly that it was actually invasive.
Mm-hmm. It was a water hyacinth. Was
water
that?
Hyacinth, yep. That's right.
Yeah, that was an ornamental plant originally. You could purchase it in nurseries, and that's illegal now because it is quite an aggressive invasive species. But you know, it just kind of shows that you can be pretty well intentioned and not know about these things. And once you keep an eye out and know what to look for, you learn that they're invasive, just as the gal in our story that we featured. You know, learning that they're invasive and then learning what you can do and feel empowered about how to monitor for invasive species and who to report them to.
Are there, how could you tell if, what are the best ways to know if a waterway is actually healthy?
Oh gosh, there are so many things that go into making a waterway healthy. There's actually a whole program with the Wisconsin DNR dedicated to this, our Healthy Waterways program. And they have a huge equation of things that go into making water healthy. So taking into account aquatic invasive species, different types of pollutants, you know, how much sediment might be in the water. There are all sorts of things.
Yeah, there are even animals, some of the water animals that if they're there, it can be a sign.
Yeah, different types of maybe more rare species or species that are susceptible to pollutants.
So now let's go back here in our last minute and to the participation part of this, which is you can still sign up.
Mm-hmm.
How do you sign up for this?
On our webpage, wateractionvolunteers.org/events, there is a link to the Aquatic Invasive Species Snapshot Day webpage. You can find a little bit more information there, and there's also a link to register. Also, just like to note that a snapshot day is really for everyone. It's really for all abilities. We recommend ages 8 and up. Minors must be accompanied by an adult. And, you know, even if you don't want to get in the water, if you don't want to touch aquatic plants, we understand there are plenty of ways to help from the shoreline. But if you're interested in getting in the water, wading in a little bit to get a closer look at things, that's an option too. And you really do not have to be an expert. Feel free to show up with, you know, little to no background. The site leaders are amazing. They're going to teach you everything that you need to know and help you out.
And I bet if you type in Aquatic Invasive Species Snapshot Day.
That'll do it too.
Which might be the easier thing to remember.
Yeah.
Here. Aquatic Invasive Species Snapshot Day. And it's coming up this Saturday.
That's right.
But you can still sign up for it, and you learn a lot more about aquatic invasives and have some fun in the process. Emily Heald, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Appreciate it. Emily is a Rivers Outreach Specialist, and we have a link, by the way, on our program page on the Larry Mueller Show to the proper link as well. It was great to have her with us. And thank you for joining in. Appreciate it very much, and a big thanks to our whole team, Clara Neipert and Joel Patnott, our producers, our technical directors, Lee Rayburn and Jeff Robbins, of course, our executive producer, Jill Nadeau. I'm Larry Mueller. I hope you have a good rest of the day, but stay with us. Lots more in store here on WPR News.